Welcome to Reasonable Faith with William Lane Craig. We have lots of questions on free will that have come into us, and we'll look at them in just a moment. I'm Kevin Harris, but first we want to introduce a special guest here in studio with us. Dr. Craig, if you would, do the honors.
It is a privilege, Kevin. Dr. John Herring is the president and executive director of Reasonable Faith, and it has been such a pleasure to work with John. He is very capable. He is a man of vision, great organizational ability, and real passion for the ministry. And John is also the teaching pastor and minister to adults at Johnson Ferry Baptist Church in Atlanta, where Jan and I attend. So he carries or wears a number of hats, both with Reasonable Faith and in his role as a pastor. So it's been just a joy to work with John in developing Reasonable Faith as a ministry.
Dr. Herring, you jumped in with both feet. You really did. What are some of the things that you've seen happen with Reasonable Faith since you've taken over?
Well, my association with Dr. Craig began as a college pastor when I was serving in a local church, and I was on the front lines of trying to do ministry in a situation where students were trying to defend their faith, and I was trying to equip them to defend their faith and failing quite miserably. And that's how I began to discover some of Dr. Craig's materials and became a real fan of Dr. Craig. And then I was fortunate to move from Texas, where I was living, to Atlanta. And when I saw this church that I was thinking about going to be on staff with, I saw that Dr. Craig taught Sunday school at the church, and I was to be over the Sunday school ministry as one of my responsibilities. I could not believe it.
Wow.
And I thought, what a great endorsement of the church, and what a great opportunity to get to know Dr. Craig personally. And so I was very happy to move to Atlanta, and we began working with Dr. Craig first as just as a pastor to one of our leaders there. The first year I was at the church in Atlanta, we hosted a wonderful apologetics conference. And it was just a thrill for me to meet, not only to work with Dr. Craig, but to meet some of these great giants of the intellectual and philosophical world, Christian worldview. Really phenomenal. From there, we began to develop a real heart for getting Bill's material and his message out to a wider audience. And there were a number of lay people at Johnson Ferry, people that are a part of Bill's, really, Sunday school class, his Defenders class, who began to have a dream, a vision, of putting together a nonprofit organization to help get Bill's material out into the public domain. And actually, Kevin is really quite responsible for this, because it was really you, Kevin, that had the idea to do some sort of radio show. And I think it was even you who suggested the title of the show, Reasonable Faith. And here we are 4 or 5 years later now, not necessarily radio, but through the miracle of the internet, now reaching tens of thousands of people every week with the Reasonable Faith podcast, with the Defenders class, with Dr. Craig's audio blog, and all the other resources we have on the website. It's been a ride.
You know, John, I noticed the same thing that you did, and that is that the lay people outside of the universities and academia, were beginning to discover Dr. Craig. And I said, we really need to facilitate this and keep this going. This is something very interesting that God is doing. And and I don't even think Bill knew that people outside of academia were actually discovering him and discovering who he was and really needing and wanting his resources. Now, Reasonable Faith chapters are starting to spring up. That's something new as well. Talk a little bit about that.
We couldn't be any more excited about that, because it's a physical and local expression of the content that we're putting out on the website. And so you have guys like Chris Shannon in our Dallas chapter, who has a passion for apologetics, who is very well versed in apologetics, and who wants to see a movement toward rational Christian thought in his local area happen. And what he's discovering is, and others are discovering in their areas, that they may feel like they're on an island of sorts, that they're the only ones that really are interested in this area, but through technology, through networking, through Facebook, and through the Reasonable Faith website, they realize that, no, there's other people who want to gather, who want to talk, and want to use these meetings to train themselves, to get equipped, and also to minister to people in their area who have objections to Christianity. So what we see chapters doing is really taking the content from the website and putting the rubber on the road in individual places and cities. We are very excited about this. In fact, when we first put the word out through our mailing list, our email list, about the opportunity to hold a chapter or to form a chapter, we were overwhelmed with the response from all over the world. I mean, it really just was amazing. Now, it's not an easy thing to start a chapter. There's a process, mm-hmm. and you can find out about all of that on our website.
Go to reasonablefaith.org, reasonablefaith.org. Find out how to set up a chapter in your area.
Right, but we are very excited about the future of chapters expressing the heart of reasonable faith.
One of the things that we've done with the reasonable faith that is very cutting edge is that rather than do traditional broadcasts, we've done podcasts because we're ahead of the curve here. That's where broadcast is going. It's going online, but there's always the possibility that we could expand into broadcast and onto radio that would point people to the podcast and point people to the website. So that brings up an issue, one of our favorite topics. Talk a little bit about giving to Reasonable Faith.
Kevin, we are so excited about what God has done through this ministry on literally a shoestring budget. I don't know if people understand this, but maybe this podcast will help them understand the structure of the organization Reasonable Faith. It is a 501c3 nonprofit organization recognized by the IRS. And so people that choose to give to the ministry, either through our website or through the P.O. box, they receive a receipt just like you would from a church or from a charitable organization. You get a tax deduction from that. And we are very excited about that. But Kevin, we have operated this ministry really for the last 4 years on a literal shoestring. We have some wonderful donors, many of them in the Atlanta area. We've got a good base in Southern California and here in Texas. But people are giving to Reasonable Faith now that we have our website from all over the world. One of the things that I do in my role as the president of the board of directors is to try to help support the ministry financially. We have a great base of donors who some of them are able to give large gifts, and we really appreciate that. We really try to operate the budget for Reasonable Faith as prudently as we possibly can. But the thing that really excites me, Kevin, is that the majority of our gifts come from people that are giving just $10 and $20 a month. They go to the Reasonable Faith website, they sign up to be a recurring giver, and it does it automatically. It's all safe and secure. They sign up for $10 or $20 or $50 a month. And these are the donors that are really helping Reasonable Faith share the gospel around the world and supporting the ministry. So we really want to encourage people, if they use the website, if they've been blessed by what Bill is doing and by the content there on the site, we really encourage them to pray about partnering with us to support the ministry of Reasonable Faith, even at a small level. A college student or a young family, $10 or $20 a month would be absolutely wonderful. There are many others who could give much larger gifts, and we certainly need those as well, as we really have big dreams and plans and visions for the future of the ministry. So there's mechanisms for doing that on the website. They can click on their profile, they can click the donate button, and they can sign up to be that recurring giver, or they can give a check through our P.O. box, which is also listed on the website. Supporting the ministry with sustaining gifts, some of them on a monthly basis, $10, $20, $50, $100. Some are able to give larger gifts. We've had some donors give some very significant gifts. But just so that people know, our annual budget for 2010, our proposed budget, somewhere around $130,000. And that's reaching tens of thousands of people across the world every week with wonderful content. And we had a donor we met in the Dallas area who looked at our budget, Kevin, last year, and was shocked and said, "I can't believe that this ministry is doing so much with so little." And what we're excited about for the future is really expanding what we do in Reasonable Faith. We have dreams. We have vision. We would love to expand the offerings on the website in multiple languages. We have people that visit our website from over 120 countries around the world. But right now, there's very little on the website in languages other than English. We'd love to translate the website into Chinese and into German and into Russian and whatever else we could come up with there. So we are very excited about the possibilities of doing that. But Kevin, it takes money to do that.
Let me tell you something interesting is that I've actually talked to people who are atheists who have given to this because they appreciate the content. They're interested in the philosophy and theology that Dr. Craig brings and that Reasonable Faith brings. And so they say, "Well, you know what? This is free to me, and I'd like to donate." I've got emails right here in my lap from former atheists who are really studying Dr. Craig's material. I've got an email here from a young Jewish man who is considering Christianity, and he has a few questions. He's written to us. And so this should really spur us, just these emails alone. This is a worthy ministry and worth giving to.
We couldn't be any more excited about the evangelistic thrust of the ministry. The ministry really functions on different levels, Kevin. We have a strong evangelical ministry, a strong evangelistic presence on the internet where people are literally, Bill, coming to Christ and being encouraged in their faith as they're reading about an intelligent argument for Christianity. We're knocking down those barriers that are keeping people from coming to Christ. People from all over the world, Bill, maybe you could share a story or two about that.
It has been encouraging to get feedback from folks in different countries. Just this week, I read an email that came into the forum about a fellow who said that after years of being an unbeliever, he has come back to faith and has come to Christ again. And it was so encouraging to see people moving in that direction, because you so often hear stories of people moving in the other direction, losing Christian faith. And it's just a thrill to me to think that reasonable faith could be the avenue through which many people would move from unbelief to faith in God. And the most recent question of the week that I have answered is from a person who is moving in that direction and needs some help along the way. So it's been very encouraging to me to see the response from people who are, as yet, still unbelievers, but appreciate the ministry, appreciate the openness and the honesty with which we address the questions, and who are absorbing this material and many of them making steps toward Christ.
Dr. Herring, I really want to see people sign up for the newsletter as well, and they can do that by going to the website?
They sure can. We would love for people to come to the website and sample the content. Strategically, Kevin, we've offered all of the content on the website for free. You don't have to pay for anything. You don't even have to sign up necessarily to receive content or to read content on the website. But if you do register as a user on reasonablefaith.org, it opens up a little bit more of the website for you to use. And then on your profile, you'll have an opportunity to receive Bill's monthly newsletter, or e-letter, really. It comes to your email box. And Bill does a great job in this monthly newsletter of updating people that are users of the website and where he's been and what he's doing.
You really get behind the scenes. That's what's so good about these newsletters, because you may hear rumors about how a certain debate went or something like that, but you get the straight dope, so to speak. You get the real deal when you get this newsletter.
You do, and Bill tells such great stories, and Bill's had an opportunity to travel even this year to some really wonderful places. And he does a great job in the newsletter of giving us the behind-the-scenes look at his travels there in the United States, but also overseas.
One other thing, Kevin, that we've just initiated for folks who are email subscribers to the Reasonable Faith website is we're starting to send out the question of the week now automatically to folks who want to receive it. So they don't need to come to the website in order to read that week's question. This can be automatically emailed to them. So any folks who are frequenters to the website and would like to get the question of the week automatically sent to them can sign up for that.
Outstanding. Dr. John Herring, great job. Thank you for all that you do. It seems to me that you've kind of indicated just from talking to you where we're going in the future, but any other thoughts on how we want to expand and take a reasonable faith continually around the world?
We would love to. We have big dreams again, Kevin. I mentioned the translation of the site into some of the major languages of the world, that's certainly important. But those of us that work with Dr. Craig, the board of directors, which is 9 people, lay people that have come around Dr. Craig in the ministry, we would love to see Dr. Craig be a voice on a national level here in the United States. And so we would love to be able to provide some resources, particularly with the publicist, to help Dr. Craig get on some of these national shows, these news shows or these news magazines, where frankly, it's a little disappointing sometimes, Kevin, when you see the caliber of guests that some of these folks have. And we believe, at Reasonable Faith, the board of directors, we believe that Dr. Craig is the most credible voice for Christianity and Christian philosophy, really, we believe, in the world. But we think the United States, people in the U.S. really need to hear from Dr. Craig when it comes to important issues in culture. And so we want his name to be on that Rolodex when that producer at the Today Show or Hannity or whatever is looking for a guest, and we need some help with that.
You're not the only one who thinks that about Dr. Craig, but a multitude of atheists, agnostics, skeptics, and people of other faiths, people of no faith, think the same thing. And so we've got an important ministry here, and we appreciate it. Thank you for spending some time with us, and come back and see us.
Thank you much, Kevin. Appreciate it.
All right, then, let's get to some questions, and we get them at reasonablefaith.org. Thank you for your questions. We have three questions here, Dr. Craig, on our freedom of the will. These come up quite a lot. That and the moral argument, those questions come up a lot. This question says, Dr. Craig, am I right in saying that on a compatibilist account of human freedom, and we'll define that in just a moment, on a compatibilist account of human freedom, all of God's knowledge can be reduced to either natural knowledge or free knowledge, because given a deterministic account of human freedom, there is no contingency involved in human action? Boy, that's a mouthful.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of listeners will say, yeah, well, what?
I just glazed over. But let's start with compatibilism. What is that view?
Well, this is the view that freedom is compatible with being causally determined to do what you do. So you do something at best voluntarily, in the sense that it's not as though you're forced kicking and screaming to do what you do. You do it voluntarily, but nevertheless, you're causally determined to do it by factors outside of yourself. That would be a compatibilist view of freedom.
Okay. And so he says, on a compatibilist account of human freedom, and by the way, would you consider yourself compatibilist?
No, I wouldn't. I would think that if you're causally determined to do something, then you don't do it freely. It's not enough for the action to be voluntary. It needs to be not causally determined by factors outside yourself.
Okay. Now, if one were a compatibilist, would all of God's knowledge be reduced to either natural knowledge or free knowledge?
Well, we need to define what we mean by those terms, natural knowledge and free knowledge. What he is referring to here is the doctrine of middle knowledge. Luis Molina, who is the father of this doctrine, distinguished three different moments logically within God's knowledge. God's natural knowledge is God's knowledge of all necessary truths. For example, 2 plus 2 equals 4, or anything that has a shape has a size, or anything that begins to exist has a cause. These are metaphysically necessary truths that belong to God's natural knowledge. This knowledge is essential to God. He could not have lacked it, because these are truths or propositions. It could not have been false. God's middle knowledge, then, is his knowledge of subjunctive conditionals concerning what human agents would freely do in any circumstances God might place them. For example, he knows the truth of the proposition, if Barry Goldwater had been elected president, he would have won the Vietnam War. God knows whether that is true or false, that subjunctive conditional. That's called middle knowledge. And then, according to Molina, on the basis of his middle knowledge and his natural knowledge, God decrees to create a certain world, to actualize a particular world. And then God has what Molina called free knowledge of the world that actually exists. And this is called free knowledge because it's not essential to God. God could have created a different world, and in that case, he would have had different knowledge. For example, God knows that Kevin Harris is the voice of reasonable faith, but if he had created a world in which you didn't exist, he would not have known that truth. He would have known some other truth instead. So free knowledge is knowledge that God has of the actual world that he might have lacked. And the question is basically, if everything is determined, if there is no freedom of the will, then is there any middle knowledge? Or is everything just natural knowledge or free knowledge?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the answer to that is yes, that if there is no freedom of the will, if freedom of the will is not possible, that is to say, if everything is necessarily causally determined, then everything that God knows is either natural knowledge, it's necessary truths, or it's free knowledge, it's the contingent truths that God has determined to happen. So if you eat pizza for lunch, That's true because God determined it, not because you freely chose it. God determined that you would eat pizza for lunch. Anything that appears to be a free choice is actually determined by God. So on this view, there really are no subjunctive conditionals of freedom, or are there, as they're sometimes called, counterfactuals of freedom. There aren't any such things, and so there wouldn't be any middle knowledge. There would just be natural knowledge and free knowledge.
So Molina was really trying to answer the questions that arise among the tension between God's sovereignty and his and what God determines, and the fact that God wants to somehow preserve our freedom and our free will.
That's exactly right. Molina was an unrelenting libertarian about freedom. He was not a compatibilist. He believed that human beings have significant freedom to act as they choose, independent of being causally determined. Now, certainly there are causal antecedents of our choices, but they are not so specific as to determine everything that we choose and do. Molina believed that we have significant freedom to choose as we will among various options. And so he wanted to reconcile this with God's sovereignty by saying that prior to his divine decree to create a world, God knew how different people would freely choose in different situations he might place them in. And therefore, by choosing to create certain situations and place certain people in them, God knew exactly how they would freely choose. And that's how he has foreknowledge in the actual world. So on libertarian freedom, there is this type of knowledge called middle knowledge that doesn't seem to play any role if you deny human freedom and think that everything that we choose and do is simply determined by God's choice.
Molina took his vitamins, apparently. I mean, his insight, I think, is just unbelievable. Unbelievably profound.
It's so subtle. And when you think that he wrote this in the last part of the 1500s, it's late medieval thought, and yet it is so, so powerful and so subtle. It is remarkable testimony to his genius.
Here's another question along the same lines. Dr. Craig, how does a libertarian understand total depravity? Now, we just defined libertarian. We might want to go over that again, what we mean by if someone is a libertarian.
This would be someone who thinks that our choices are not causally determined by factors outside of ourselves. They can be causally shaped by these antecedent factors, but they're not determined. For example, I'm not free to begin speaking Vietnamese right now because I don't have the causal antecedents of having learned Vietnamese. It's not within my ability to suddenly do that. But I would have the ability to freely begin to speak German right now because I do have that in my background. But I'm not determined to begin speaking German or English right now. I can make a choice. I have it within my ability to make that free decision. And that would be libertarian view of freedom.
Now, how does a libertarian understand total depravity? We would need to define total depravity as well.
The doctrine of total depravity does not mean that man is as evil as he can possibly be, that he is totally depraved in the sense that he is utterly evil, as bad as can possibly be. Rather, it means that there is no facet of human being that is untainted by sin. It's total in the extent of its influence over man. And I think the best analogy I've ever heard of this would be a drop of ink, which is placed in a glass of water. The water doesn't become totally black. It's not as black as it can be. But nevertheless, the ink diffuses itself throughout the entire glass of water. The water is totally affected by the ink. So that's what total depravity means, is that sin affects every aspect of the human personality and human being.
I believe it was Norm Geisler that said that the image of God is effaced in mankind, but not erased, that we can still see glimmers of it despite the fall.
That was a significant debate between Catholic and Protestant theologians, whether or not the image of God in man was completely annihilated in virtue of the fall. And I would say something I think quite similar, that man is still in the image of God, in that we are persons and are capable of relating to God, but our relationship with him is ruptured. And so I would say that the libertarian would understand the doctrine of total depravity in exactly the same way that I just enunciated it, namely sin affects every area of the human personality. But it doesn't mean that we're as black as can be, that we're totally evil. It means that our will is also affected by our fallenness and our sin.
When I look around at the world, I can see that we live in a fallen world, but I can also see kind of what's left and God's blessings despite the fall. You know, and man's progress by the grace of God that we should have had a long time ago had it not been for the fall, it wouldn't be an issue. But, you know, I look out the window now and I see the beauty of God's world, even though I also can see some litter down on the street.
Yes. And you see it in other persons. When you see those films or hear the stories of those firefighters that were going up the stairs in the World Trade Center when others were fleeing down the stairs, you cannot help but see the nobility and the courage and the goodness of man, even in fallen creatures. I'm sure that many of those firefighters were not Christians and yet gave their lives and out of a sense of duty to their fellow human beings. And certainly you do see the goodness and the nobility of man, clearly even in his fallenness.
Let's do one more, Dr. Craig, and tackle this one. It says, Dr. Craig, how should we understand original sin philosophically? It doesn't seem to make sense that we are held responsible for another person's actions. In other words, because of what Adam and Eve did, we're held responsible and so on. If we utilize middle knowledge, we could say that God knows that if we were in a similar circumstance to Adam and Eve, we would have acted as they did. But it seems strange to think that God judges us by what we would do instead of what we actually do. For in this case, God might know that given a different set of circumstances, we would not have received Christ. This seems that it would result in some strange theological conundrums.
Certainly would. And I completely agree with him that God cannot judge us on the basis of what we would have done under different circumstances rather than what we actually do. Under other circumstances, I might have been a Nazi war criminal or a murderer, but I'm not held responsible for that because I didn't actually do those things. So I completely agree with him that God would not judge us on the basis of true counterfactuals about us, how we would have acted. Nevertheless, I think that these counterfactuals can play a role in understanding the doctrine of original sin. It seems to me that what is essential to understanding the doctrine of original sin is the concept of imputation. And this is the idea that guilt or responsibility for an action can be imputed to another person from the person who actually did it. I was once talking with an insurance salesman about the gospel, sharing my faith with him. And as I described how Christ died on the cross for our sins, he said to me, "Oh, well, that's imputation." And I was shocked because I thought, how does this businessman know about the theological concept of imputation of sin? And he said, "Oh, we use imputation all the time in the insurance industry." And he described to me how you can have certain policies, for example, on your automobile, where if somebody else drives your car and gets in a wreck, the responsibility for the damage is imputed to you rather than the person who was actually driving. So that imputation was a very familiar concept to this man because of his work in insurance. And that, I think, lies at the heart of the doctrine of original sin, is that Adam was our representative before God. He was the federal head of the human race and acted on our behalf before God. It would be, again, as though a proxy voted on your behalf at a stockholders meeting. You authorize someone to act as your proxy, and what he votes is actually your vote because of his proxy relationship to you. Similarly, Adam, I think, was our proxy before God. He was our representative before God in the actions that he took in falling into sin. And lest anyone would say, well, I don't want him as my representative, right? He doesn't represent me. That's where I think the counterfactuals would come in. Namely, what is true is that if we were in Adam's situation, we would have acted exactly the same way, and therefore he is capable of serving as our proxy and representative. He does not misrepresent us before God. So the reader is right in saying God doesn't judge us on the basis of how we would have acted in other circumstances, but I think that how we would have acted in those circumstances in which Adam found himself is relevant to whether Adam is able to act as our proxy, whether he faithfully represents us before God, and therefore serves as our federal head. And so I think it's basically the doctrine of imputation that serves here as the basis for the sort of corporate fall of humanity in Adam's fall.
Thank you so much for listening to Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig, and we'll pick it up there next time and answer some more questions that we receive at reasonablefaith.org. One more time, if you would like to start a Reasonable Faith chapter in your area, information is at reasonablefaith.org. And by the way, if you appreciate the information that you get at reasonablefaith.org and you would like to see these podcasts continue and see us branch out even further, then be a partner with us. You can find out how when you go to reasonablefaith.org. Your financial and prayer support means a great deal to us. That's reasonablefaith.org, and we'll see you next time on Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig.